Yeah. So I'm not the last talk, and I won't have to thank everybody for staying till the bitter end. That'll be Thomas's role. So I should just say a couple things before I start. First, this is joint work with Kevin Quinn, and some of it's mine, some of it's Kevin's, and some of it's joint. I'll try to let you know when which is which. Second, this is designed for problems where you can never possibly hope to get the right answer. So let's just admit that right now. The real question is whether you can learn something or anything. And then finally, this talk is probably two-thirds about translation and one-third about just adding something on to something. So the idea here is to take the two-thirds is about kind of translating things that are already out there into a format that can be digested by a general social science audience. Okay, so structured talk in three ways. I'll give a quick example and then state kind of the goals for this work, and then do a quick bit on just definitions and notation and how we're going to translate that, and then finish up with the Bayesian model, which was on the original title. Okay, so here's an example. So democratic theorists like to talk a lot about turnout and about differential turnout. It has a lot of implications for theories about government, et cetera. And in particular, registration rules are thought to have some effect on turnout and possibly have differential effects on different subpopulations. Registration rules are set by each state, and they're different. Okay. And this is just a polite way of kind of getting at what people are really talking about here, which is that Southern states used registration rules to systematically disenfranchise African Americans, and people are concerned that some of the things that are still around may still be doing that. Okay. All right. So I'm just going to do very, very simple models today. So let's assume we have a Y variable which indicates whether or not you vote. And I'm going to, at some points, have a V for that as well later on. Sorry about that. We will have an X variable that indicates whether or not somebody has Election Day registration available. So there are six states now that have Election Day registration available. There's also one state that effectively has no registration that's not included in this analysis. So that will sometimes be called EDR. Yeah, North Dakota is just... You're registered. You don't have to do it. The state takes the responsibility for maintaining the lists. And in fact, among modern democracies, the U.S. is the only one that puts that burden on its citizens.
I wonder why.
Yeah. Yeah. So, anyways, as I said, the last slide was the polite way of saying all of that. Okay. So then we're going to have an intermediate variable Z, which will sometimes be written as R for registration. So, and this is, you know, measured on day of whatever. So the causal order is going there, there, maybe that. We'll talk about that later. And then, you know, I'm not going to say at this point anything about confounding. Okay. All right. So Chris noted, did a survey of all of this and noted that, okay, well, wait a second. Even if you're really interested in turnout, right, registration's going to tell you a lot about it, right? We know you can't vote if you don't register. So in some sense, it should be included in the analysis, right? But most studies don't, and the reason they don't is they don't know how to do it correctly. That is somewhat of a problem because we might think that there's information there that we could use. But kind of the flip side of that and other problems is even worse. People are pretty aware now in, say, the soft social sciences that you can't just run around using the linear structural equation model assumptions anymore. But what they do instead is they just run a bunch of regressions and then make heuristic arguments that are exactly equivalent to the linear structural equation model assumptions. So they get around saying, oh, okay, this is what I really mean, but then they interpret it later. So one goal of this talk is to, or this project in general, is just to make very explicit the assumptions that are being made by people so that they can argue about them. All right, so I guess I'll go through these, and I like the word demystify. That's been thrown around this conference. So that's goal number one, is just to kind of demystify or translate some results that have come about in the last few years about direct effects, indirect effects, and post-treatment analysis. And when I say last few years, I mean last probably 15 years or 20 years, because it takes that long for these things to trickle down into some fields in the social sciences. We're also going to say, okay, observational causal inference, especially in some of the situations that political scientists are looking at, is pretty difficult. So if we can provide other options for assumptions, maybe some of those will be reasonable. And then hopefully provide a means for weakening some of the typical assumptions that people use. And then, okay, so this is the one we can argue about later on, but if you flip open the American Political Science Review to any random page, most likely you will find an article that has the following format. It does some theory, maybe some sort of a game theory model, followed by a regression or a bunch of regressions, and then followed by some case studies. Okay. Now, typically those case studies are not connected very well to the regression results. So in some sense, we're going to show in this model that you can do that if you want to. You're making a huge assumption, but if they're already making stronger assumptions when they talk about these case studies, so you know, at least make it clear. All right, so definitions and translations. We use the standard, start off with the standard potential outcomes notation. So I should just note really quickly, when I say demystifying here, if you start off with potential outcomes to a large proportion of many social science audiences, you will lose 75% of your audience immediately. Okay? So one of the things we're going to, now some people would say that's a good thing, but
that's a feature that I like.
Yeah. but unfortunately, I think you would find that we are losing them not for the reason that you would say to lose them. No, they want to talk about effects in the standard structural equation. So I'm just going to do a quick translation here into something that should be more familiar to the general social science audience. So here's just standard potential outcome framework. You know, we have always, never, helped, and hurt. Right. So again, X is our original treatment, and Y is our outcome. And so this is a table kind of like Rubin uses sometimes. The only real difference is I'm going to put in these sets in this case, because I've made everything binary. I can just list everything that's possible when we don't actually observe the potential outcome. So when X is 0, we don't observe Y of 1, but we do know it's in this set. Okay, that'll be useful for bounding later. All right, and we can get the same thing for the potential post-treatment variables. So in this case, this is having to do with registration. And then we can do the same for joint potential outcomes. So in this case, I'm just going to, just to be clear, the first position is always the X variable, or the first variable, and the second position is always the Z variable, or the second variable. Okay, so that's just to get notation down so we're all squared away. Right? And then you know, this has been remarked on before, but just to remind people, if you haven't seen this, we can write the potential outcomes as a redundant version of the joint potential outcomes and the potential intermediate variable, right? So this is the y that you would get if x were 0 is the y you would get if x were 0 and z were what it would be if x were 0, right? And you can write that out as these will come into play later. You can write that out just as a combination of the potential intermediate variables and the potential outcomes, right? Other side. And then basically you can do the same sort of thing for counterfactual outcomes, right? So I can instead say, what would y be if x were 0, but z were what it would be if y were 1? Right? And that sounds like kind of a crazy thing, but it turns out that it's really no crazier than assuming all the potential outcomes in the first place, so because we can write it out just using this algebraic formulation. Okay, so simple algebra. So I'm now going to go to the kind of the standard decomposition of this into direct and indirect effects. So if we write out the total effect as the redundant version, add and subtract a counterfactual here, then we get, you know, when x is 0, and I think I have this right, the top line is the total direct effect. When x is 1, this second line is sometimes called the pure direct effect. And so when you switch that little x to 0 or 1, 1 is indirect and 1 is direct. Okay. So just to make that clear for a second, let's go ahead and fix x is equal to 1, little x equal to 1. So when little x is equal to 1, then z here is 0, and that is a 1. So this is just conceptually the idea of changing x while holding z at the value it would have held if x had been 0. So that's sometimes called the pure direct effect. Okay, so then here's the translation. So unfortunately that green is not coming out very well. But let me just walk through it. Basically, this is just algebra from the last slide to this slide. But what it allows us to do is to put things back into kind of the path analysis type of framework, right? So basically what you can see is that the total effect is just going to be the indirect path is the product of the effect of x on z and the effect of z on y for a particular level of x. And then the direct effect is just going to be either the control direct effect of x on y when z is 0 or the control direct effect of x on y when z is 1, and that's determined by whatever z value z takes on given the little value of x that you've chosen. So this is actually two decompositions here. But the idea is that now we can kind of say that the total effect can be decomposed in these two decompositions into an indirect effect and a direct effect, where the indirect effect is this product of effects, at least on an individual level. So that matches up with what people remember from the linear structural equation model framework. Okay, and then this is going to make certain results that have been published already easier to understand and to relate to each other. So in particular, if we think, let's start for a second just by thinking about the green here. And I'm going to choose x to be 1 so that this is the pure direct effect. Okay, and then if we ask about how do we identify the average pure direct effect, right? I just take an expectation. That was an individual thing on the previous slide, so I just take an expectation over it. And you can see that what we're left with, the only problematic thing is this product here. Right, so if I just write that out, then I just end up with a covariance term. But all of the major identification criteria can be seen in this covariance term. So for instance, when you have causal effect homogeneity, then these things are just going to be, you're going to get a constant on one side of that, so the covariance goes away. When the Pearl's condition of the intermediate potential variable being independent of the joint potential outcomes, that means that this z0 is independent of every single term here. The Peterson, Senesi, Vanderlaan result, so which is that the intermediate potential variable is mean independent of each of the control direct effects. So that just means that this is independent of this, this is independent of this, so it goes away. And then this just also connects it very easily with the no interaction result from Robbins 2003, which is just if there's no interaction, then this right-hand side of this covariance is identically 0 for everybody. Okay, so again, just translation. It also allows us to kind of simplify what one might think about the front door criterion and adjustment. And to start to think about doing sensitivity analysis for this. So in an informal sense, the front door criterion requires these things. So we have to assume no direct effect. We have to assume that the average effect of x on z is identified, the average effect of z on y is identified, and that there's independence between the effects. right? And that can be seen very easily from this framework, because if the direct effect is zero, then the total effect is just the product of those things. So again, you end up with just a covariance term that goes away under the assumption of independence. But you can see where that assumption is coming from, and you can start to make claims about how far off you might be on these average effects and how far you, I mean, you just have to make a guess about that covariance, right? That's, you know, people, front door criteria guesses it's zero. You can guess whatever you want. Okay. It also makes it a little bit easier, I think, to look at some of the bounding analysis. So for instance, here's the stuff from Kuroki and Kai, and then the Kaufman paper, which Jay presented on his poster earlier in the week. I didn't know about this yet, but this is the same kind of thing. So here's the analysis when essentially you don't make any assumptions. Z isn't doing anything here other than defining the indices on these n's, right? So this is just n when x is equal to 0, z is equal to 0, and y is equal to 0, right? And I'm just doing this for the control units in this case. For the registration law example, we might actually think that that's the population that we actually care about, because they're probably not going to take away Election Day registration from anybody. What we'd be interested in is what would happen if they gave Election Day registration to the states that don't have it, right? So anyways, this, the other thing this does is it relates it to individual level effects, which is really what many people think about more naturally than these average effects. So basically, you can just see for each row in the table, you can see the possibilities for the individual level effects, and then it's pretty easy to get to the average effects just by averaging over the lowest values and then averaging over the largest values, right? Okay. So just pay attention to this upper bound here. So then, and that's just reprinted there. So now if we make assumptions that are probably pretty reasonable in this Election Day registration example, that the direct effect is zero, and I'll relax that later, and that you can't vote without registering, right? Then using the decomposition, it's pretty easy to see the total effects are going to be the red delta times the blue delta on the individual level, right? And so if you just take, you know, products of everything in those two sets, you get the set over here. And it's easy enough just to cross out values based on the assumptions you're making. And what you find is that you get rid of the negative ones here and the ones here. And so you reduce the bounds, right? So, and the upper bound is really the one to look at. The lower bound is kind of a trivial example in this registration case, because one of these, this N001 doesn't have anybody in it, right? But we've reduced the upper bound. So, I mean, in this example, that's kind of intuitively obvious, right? If we look at this one up here, these are people who did not have Election Day registration, were registered, but did not vote. So, you know, in order to say that those people are really going to be a part of that effect, you have to come up with some story whereby Election Day registration is going to cause them to vote, not through making them register, right? So, you know, this is just a simple example. It shows that basically, and again, this is kind of just a repeat of what you would find in those papers here, although I'm doing it on a slightly different on the control units. But it makes it very easy to see, and it's a clear example of where you learn something that would not, making two potentially reasonable assumptions that would not have been available to you if you had not considered the post-treatment variable. So people in this room are not as dogmatic about this as people in our field, but in political science. It is typically felt that you can get nothing but post-treatment bias from a post-treatment variable. So this is just kind of a demonstration that that is not true in general. You can get something. All right, but we might want to essentially be able to weaken either these two assumptions or start to incorporate other types of assumptions into this framework, deal with uncertainty due to sample size, et cetera. Right. And so now we're going to take this Bayesian. And so what this is, the next section is essentially a combination of Kevin's work that he did on a 2x2 table with a Bayesian sensitivity analysis and then the path stuff that I had previously. Okay, so here's the idea then, and we're going to use the same decomposition. I'm just going to go through an example to explain how we elicit this. So the way we're getting at this problem is to elicit lots of things that we think people can think about. But there's a lot, so that's the trade-off. Okay, so suppose that we're going to condition on the observed x, c, and y. Right, that gives us some values in this decomposition. Right, and we're first going to ask people to tell us what's the probability, in this case, given these observed values, that z of 1 is equal to 1. So you could just give me a probability, or we could put some sort of a beta distribution on that. Notice that that is parameterized in the direction of an effect. We're always going to be asking people what's the probability of an effect. So that's the effect. What's the probability of an effect of x on z? Okay. And then the second one, we need to then condition on whatever we got from the first stage effect. So I'm going to go ahead and assume that we got a 0 there for that first stage of effect. Right. So no effect there. So I can do this as an effect. So then we ask, what's the probability that you got an effect for the effect of z on y? Okay, and again, if we want to, we can put a beta on that. And then finally, this one's a little more complicated, but basically conditional on what you get for the red z of 1 and the blue joint potential outcome here, then you're going to, the z tells you which of these, whether you're dealing with this guy or with this guy. And then conditional. So if you don't need the blue if you're dealing with this one. But if you're dealing with this control direct effect, then it's vital that you've conditioned on this potential, on the actual draw of this potential outcome here. So this is just kind of one example of how one starts to go through the elicitation procedure. It's also kind of a description of the sampling procedure that we're using. It's just straightforward. There's nothing difficult about the sampling at this point. There will be when you start putting certain constraints on things. Okay, so let's just see what this looks like in an example. So here is CPS data on election day registration, whether or not people were registered and whether or not they voted, and this is for African Americans in 2004. And you'll notice that you get the true zeros that you'd expect to get. Right. So if you didn't register, you didn't vote. Okay, and then here's the specification problem. So, like I said, and this is not the whole thing. At this point, we're assuming that there's no direct effect. Okay, so I mean, there's a trade-off here, right? You can have a small number of things to elicit, or you can have what we think are things to ask that people can think about and argue about. This is it. So. I'll just walk you through one example here. So if we look down here, and we're going to need to obviously translate this a lot more. This is and make this easier to use. But this is the probability. So this alpha 0, 0, 0 here is given x equals 0, z equals 0, y equals 0. What's the probability that election day registration would cause you to register? Given that you're in a state. Yeah, give.
Pre-register, you didn't vote.
Yeah.
What would have been the probability that you would have voted if you had registered?
No, what would have been the probability that you would have registered if election day registration had been available to you? Okay, so it's the first stage effect. Okay, and now you can see, so, you know, we have this set up, you know, roughly between 0 and 0.25, but this is going to be one of the key ones that you're going to have to wiggle, right? But now, what you can see is that the fact that you have to specify all of these parameters is not necessarily a bad thing, right? Because if you think about this one, suppose that you were caused to register by election day registration, right? So what happens if that happens is we jump up here to beta 0001. Okay, so that is the first three are the observed things, and the fourth is the what you got on the first stage. So you were caused to register on the first stage. Well, it would be hard to make an argument that the probability for this should be anything very far away from zero. I mean, from one, rather, right? Because if EDR is causing me to register, my registration is going to cause me to vote, right? So basically, the point is that while this can look like a mess and look onerous, there is a limit to how many of these things we really need to argue about, right? And the ones that are all the way across are just the ones that get wiped out by the zeros in the table, so that's not important. And then there were some of the monotonicity assumptions that we were willing to accept completely, but we can weaken those. Okay, so this is kind of an interesting way to look at this, but we might also want to look at this back in, since we're interested in total effects, I mean, we might want to look at this in a 2x2 type of a way, right, to see what we're really saying here. So these are confounding plots that Kevin came up with in his 2x2 paper. My impression is that these effectively make tomography plots in the way that I think you suggested in the JRSSA discussion on Wakefield's 2x2 piece. But the idea here is this. The red clouds are your priors in this space. So let me describe the tables. Okay, so this legend is conditional that you had election day registration, or that no EDR and no vote. What's the probability that you would have voted had you had EDR? So these axes are now ignoring the intermediate variable, right? And this is, given that you know EDR and you voted, what's the probability that you would have voted had you had EDR as well? So what's the probability of an always? So this is given this, what's the probability of helped? Given 0, 1, what's the probability of always? This is given 1, 1, what's the probability of helped? And given 1, 0, what's the probability of a never? Right. Okay, so the red clouds are priors projected onto this space, except for now they've actually got some data in them because they've mixed up with the observed values of the intermediate variable. The blue lines here are weak ignorability. So you can compare what your assumptions were in the path-specific analysis to what you would have had to assume to get a prima facie average treatment effect in just the plain old 2x2 case. Okay. And the black bands are just kind of a bounding analysis. If you go ATE plus or minus 0.05, you can be anywhere within the black bounds. Okay, so this is just allowing us to see what our prior assumptions mean in the space that we actually care about, to some extent, this confounding space.
This is informed by the data as well?
Yeah, the red is informed by the data. So it is not just a straight projection of the priors onto this, right? Because in order to get rid of the z variable in here, we had to use data or the parameters that we're estimating with the data that we can actually, you know, estimate well. Okay. And I mean, in this case, you know, you probably don't get a whole heck of a lot more than you would get just from the bounding, right? So we had Kevin run through this, and he tried as hard as he could to come up with his best priors just in the 2x2 case, and this is what you saw earlier, the prior is there, and for the most part, you just see this, and this is the prima facie ATE. So, you know, it's mostly just the bounding, the bounds that you saw earlier that are driving this move down to something that's more reasonable, right? But, I mean, we would argue you've learned something. And I'll just give you just some, I mean, so we wanted to show a little bit of sensitivity. Obviously, it's going to take longer to do the whole thing in this case. But here, what we've done is we've allowed the idea that if you would have registered without EDR, but EDR made you procrastinate, and then something happened, and you didn't end up registering and didn't end up voting, so that's a type of an indirect of a direct effect in this case. It only occurs for a certain subpopulation, and we made the probability very small for that, but you can see the effect on these things. And sorry about the scale difference here. Basically, this slid down a little bit more because there was more of a possibility of direct effect, of the negative direct effects. Okay, so I just want to finish just by saying kind of what Kevin's been using this for in the 2x2 case, and that what we're thinking about using it for in this case as well, which is if we go back to these, trying to go back. So you can see how these beta distributions are parameterized, right? The parameters can be thought of as, you know, an observation of A1 is like an observation of an effect, and A0 is an observation of a non-effect, right? So if you think that you're actually getting that kind of information from your case study, then you can actually add it into this framework, right? So now, of course, that's assuming you're solving the fundamental problem of causal inference, but maybe in some cases that's reasonable. You know, maybe I can say, well, Chad, if they hadn't discovered oil in 1975, would not have had a civil war the next year, right? And I mean, you might be able to make a pretty plausible story for an argument like that. So I don't think it's totally out of the pale always to say that you can't add information like this. And certainly it's the kind of thing that people in my field want to do. So whether or not they should, I mean, I guess we can talk about abstinence only, but you know, this is here's, you know, the priors are the prophylactic, I guess. I don't know. So anyways, I'll finish on that note. So assumptions are going to be necessary, and they're going to be more than necessary in a lot of these problems that people are working on. In some cases, we may be able to get reasonable assumptions out of observation of post-treatment variables, and then we can do some stuff that probably one would think was crazy in some cases, right? We can use the fact that you can add cases into those priors to actually even talk about where you should go to observe things. So, you know, should you go to a country that has x equals 0, z equals 0, y equals 0, or should you go to another one? We can try to figure out where you're going to get the most information. Also, because we've gone Bayesian, we get all kinds of other crazy stuff, right? You know, so we can figure out what to do if we don't actually have a measurement of the true treatment variable, and we can estimate the joint distribution of potential outcomes because we've made them up. Except in the case where now in the 2x2 case, we're getting some data coming into those red clouds, so we're not completely making them up. And here are the references. Thanks. Yeah, Jamie.
It was really interesting. There's just references because Marshall's not here.
Oh, okay.
He wrote a whole paper on bounding effects by post-treatment variables that was, I think, published in JRSSP. It was the first one thing I've ever seen on that.
Okay, thank you. I will definitely get that in. Thank you. Yeah.
I didn't see what the specification on the bottom was, so that was your betas, that was the beta values that you put in for the back
Here? Or one more back. Oh, one more back. Yeah.
So talk me through that. So your ex-government
didn't do that. That's right. So for each of the 8 possible observed values, you have to tell me what's the probability of an effect on the first stage, the effect of the law on registration. And then now you have to tell me for each of the 8 observed values and some assumed value for the effect on the first stage, what's the effect on the second stage of the indirect path? What's the probability of the effect on that second stage? And then conditional on the observed, both of those values, you have to tell me what's the probability of a natural direct effect on the final stage. But we assumed it away here. So
when you're presenting it,
that, well, we will eventually. Yeah, it's gonna have to be written out in a way that people can, in English like that, and we would, you know, the tools for actually specifying these will hopefully be tweaked up to the point that it's easy enough for people to do them. But
So from your, this is interesting. From your point of view, if the observed data distribution did not satisfy the instrumental variable inequalities, he starts doing this. That's prior one on no direct effects. What's happening?
Well, stuff should go to the boundary. Stuff should go to the boundary.
And I'm not, and I'm leaving one thing out. I'm always not saying something about one joint potential outcome. Right? Also, Thomas, you're looking at the effect of the intermediate variable on the outcome variable. And I'm looking at the effect of the first variable on the outcome variable, and I think I'm leaving out the potential.
You're leaving out enough in the whole thing, so you
for the total effect, yeah. Because I'm not doing enough to specify one of the control direct effects. Okay, sorry. Thanks.